there.
Count to nine. 9876543211. Okay, now count again, Jack, and see if I'm...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Okay, we're running. This is Bob Brown, and I'm interviewing Jack and Louise Gault at their home in Martinsdale. Jack served as a state senator for many years and is president of the state senate and also as Republican National Committee man. Louise has been active in Republican Party politics for a number of years in Montana, and both of them have a long perspective on Montana history and the political history of Montana. Jack, maybe we could begin with you. What caused you to become interested in politics?
I think my first interest was outside of a long history of my father being in politics, but when I got interested was when they started talking about the new Constitution.
The 1972 Montana Constitution.
That's right. And I ran for that convention. I was defeated, but I ran on the basis that the Constitution we never had to have a new Constitution. There was plenty of ways to amend the present one, but I was defeated.
And then you were elected to the House of Representatives in the election right after that, though.
That's right.
House of Representatives.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that your dad was involved in politics. How was he involved in politics?
He was served in the United States Senate.
The State Senate?
In the State Senate, yeah. Excuse me. Yes, the State Senate. In the 30s.
And do you remember ever visiting with him about any of that experience?
Oh, yes, very much so. He was proud of the fact that he was there. He wasn't there very long because he changed his residence from Judith Basin to Cascade County and then had to get out of the Senate. But an interesting thing, he's served along with Louise's father.
In the State Senate?
No, I think he was in the House of Representatives.
I see. But they served at the state at the same time. Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that. Well, both of you might be able to shed some light on this. You know, when we started this project, we were especially interested in knowing about the influence of the Anaconda Company in the politics of the state. In your visits with your dad, do you remember him ever mentioning anything about that? Or,
well, to be frank, yes. My father was very close to the Anaconda Company. One of his best friends was Herbert Hoover, or not Herbert Hoover, but Harold Hoover, who was the lawyer out of Great Falls, who was president of Anaconda Copper, but one of Dad's closest friends. In fact, Dad was the executor of his estate. So yes, he was close to the Anaconda people.
And your dad was a Republican?
Yes, he was.
Now, Louise, maybe you could comment at this point. Was Bert Replogle, was your dad?
Yes, he was a Democrat.
And he was a Democrat. Okay, well, do you remember anything about his thoughts and impressions about the legislature and the Anaconda Company?
I remember one time he brought home a copper collar that presented everybody in the legislature. It was actually made of copper. And I don't know what happened to it, but he thought that was great.
The Anaconda Company did it themselves as a kind of a joke?
They did it themselves as a joke, I think. And so he didn't like the big companies. But he didn't really hate them either. He recognized there was a place for them, as long as they were being fair. But I remember mainly when they tried to impeach the governor.
Governor Frank Cooney.
Yes. He cast the one vote against impeachment. I think he only lost by one or two votes. But he was kind of torn on that one.
Huh.
But he thought the company influence was there
on
that was too strong. I remember him talking about that.
Yeah. And he felt the Anaconda Company was involved in trying to impeach Cooney.
Yes. He thought they were for the impeachment and were pushing it. That's one reason he was against it, I think.
See, okay. Do you remember your dad ever talking about that, Jack?
No, I don't. I don't remember a bit about it.
So you became interested in politics as a young man because your dad was involved, didn't you?
So was aware of politics.
Aware of politics, anyway. Yeah. And then when this idea about rewriting the state constitution
got me interested.
That got you interested in actually running for office.
Yes.
And you're a Republican because?
Well, because I was educated by my father, I guess.
See. So your dad's influence was definitely important in that regard.
Yes, I'd have to say that.
And Louise, you've been an officer in the Republican Party in Montana, I think, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Off and on for quite a number of years. And I know you were, I think you were active as a young Republican back in the early 1950s. But your dad was a Democrat legislator.
Right.
Explain.
Well, in those days you called it a Jeffersonian Democrat. He didn't care for Roosevelt. And he didn't like the New Deal. He thought it was ruining the country. He hated the WPA and thought people were... Well, his thought was that the Republicans believed that the people should support the government, and the Democrats believed the government should support the people. That was... And I was kind of going up to that type of thinking.
And that seemed closer to the Republican philosophy,
yes,
as you became of age. And
right.
So you were elected at a relatively early age as county attorney in Fergus County.
Yes.
What
right out of law school.
Right out of law school. So mm-hmm. what, 24 years old or something?
Well, let's see. 23.
23 years old and you were elected county attorney. Mm-hmm. And of course, young women were unusual as attorneys then, too. So that was pretty remarkable. And you were elected as a Republican.
Yes.
Was your father still alive?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He campaigned with me. He
I see. Okay.
In those days, you'd have rallies in the different precincts.
Was he disappointed that you were a Republican?
No, he didn't. He wasn't. He was a free thinker and thought we should think on our own.
Do you think he continued to be a Republican? Or continued to be a Democrat? Or do you think he might have changed as well?
Well, it's hard to tell. I don't know how he voted. But... He didn't call himself a Democrat much after that. He's still Ambassador Roosevelt because he'd been in for so long, yeah, you know. But he liked some Democrats and some he didn't.
He was...
He didn't like the trade that Cooney and Erickson made when T.J. Walsh died.
Yeah.
And that they were Democrats, and he thought that was wrong. But I remember him talking about, I think the papers said that... How was it? Cooney had his appointment, Erickson, to the Senate in one hand as Erickson handed him his resignation with the other.
Yeah. Well, I know that created a big stir in state politics,
yeah,
and of course Erickson was defeated in the mm-hmm. Democratic primary when he attempted to stay in the U.S. Senate,
yeah,
after that whole incident had concluded.
Right.
Now, you mentioned T.J. Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
You were married until his death to Wellington D. Rankin,
mm-hmm.
who all, I'm sure had some associations with Walsh. Do you remember ever discussing anything about Walsh with Mr. Rankin?
Oh, yes. When he first got out of law school and came back to Montana, he practiced under Walsh. It was Walsh and Nolan. I don't know, this deal called it Nolan and Walsh. It was never called Nolan and Walsh. It was always Walsh and Nolan. Walsh was the predominant lawyer there. He was probably the first and foremost workman's comp lawyer in Montana.
Walsh was?
Yeah, Walsh was. And kind of a newcomer in the field and made a wonderful name for himself that way. And he was a student. Nolan was the talker. Good, had a bit stentorian voice and everything. But Walsh was a student and really the better lawyer of the two. I remember one story after Wellington left, or I guess the firm dissolved because Walsh wanted to go to the U.S. Senate. He didn't make it this one time and then dissolved in the meantime, but they could see it coming and so they quit. No one practiced anybody or alone. But when Tiny Cruz died, the daughter died, there was a big fight. Some of these historians say that she was divorced, but she wasn't from her second husband. And there was a fight over her estate.
I see, okay.
And her husband, his name was Cotter, filed to be administrator. And some young lawyer, his lawyer, asked Wellington to help on it. And then Nolan represented Cruz. And he filed on it. And he claimed that, not that there wasn't next of kin, that they weren't married, they were divorced, but that they weren't legally married. At that time, Montana had a law that you couldn't get married after a divorce if you were the innocent party for a year and if you were the guilty party for 2 years. And that was 1800s, late 1800s. Well, anyway, when they had the hearing on it, Willington left, so he got up and he said, "Your Honor, Mr. Cotter, Mamie Cruz married Mr. Cotter because Colonel Nolan told her to." He said, he reared back in his chair in that stentorian voice he had, beautiful voice, "What's that? I did not," you know, and he repeated it. And then he went on to say, after that was passed by the legislature, Colonel Nolan was the Attorney General, and he sent an opinion out to all the lawyers in Montana to tell all the people in Montana it was unconstitutional, and that's never been overturned. So in effect, he was telling Mamie Cruz, it's all right to go ahead and marry Mr. Cotter. So.
Well, that would have been what, in about 1920, I'm thinking? Something
I think
like
so.
That?
I think a little later than that. I know I looked it up. I wanted to read the case, and I didn't write it down. But I finally found it. I think it was later than
now,
that.
Now, Sam Ford was Attorney General sometime in that period, or maybe a little before 1920, and he was an associate of Wellington D. Rankin. Wasn't
I hadn't heard that.
Well,
Anxman was.
Yeah, but I don't mean a law associate, but
oh.
I mean politically.
Oh,
They had a relationship, I think, generally a positive one
you
for
bet.
Most of the years.
The three had Ford, Wellington, and Wheeler.
Yeah.
It's the unholy triumvirate, they called them.
And of course, Wheeler was a Democrat. Now, Jack, Sam Ford, of course, went on to be governor in the early 1940s. You were a college student, I think, then, and then you served in World War II and so on. Did you ever meet Governor Ford?
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting him in the old governor's mansion.
Really?
I think we took his daughter from Bozeman, and she was in school at Bozeman, and drove her to...
Oh, Isabel?
I forget.
He had a daughter by that name anyway. I don't know if...
Anyway, that's... What
are your impressions of him? If I asked you to describe in a sentence or two Governor Sam Ford, what would you say?
I'd have to say that I never knew him that well, that I couldn't. What I hear of him and know of him, I was good, but I really don't have any strong opinions.
Louise, did you ever meet him?
Oh, yes. I knew him well. And they had me give a radio address for him in the campaign.
Really?
Which was unusual. I had to go to Great Falls to do it.
Yeah.
And very friendly with you. Very strong man. He fought the company on a lot of things, too, so he wasn't too popular with them.
He was independent of the
anti-company. Independent of them. Yeah. Very independent-minded.
Yeah.
But saw a lot of him. And
how would you describe him, if you just wanted to kind of give someone who had never met him a thumbnail sketch of what he was like?
I don't know how he'd be like at home, but strong-minded. I had an opinion, but never hesitated to take a stand on anything, whether it was popular or not. Always thought you had to do the right thing regardless.
He was strong for prohibition, I remember that, early
in
his political career.
Yes, he was.
And I think he remained sort of an unreconstructed prohibitionist.
Right.
And our friend Jerome Anderson, in my interview with him, said, but he wasn't above taking a drink from time to time.
Yeah. I know when one of his daughters was getting married, and he decided not to be married in the governor's mansion. He said, if you do, it's the governor's daughter being married. If you're not married there, it's my daughter being married.
Huh.
And he was very modest and not showy at all and didn't flaunt any of this.
Yeah.
Good person. He and Wilton fought sometimes. Each one would want to run for the same office, but they were very close friends. When he was dying at home. Well, he went up, I think, two or three times a week to visit with him.
Really?
Bed. He couldn't get out of bed and stuff. And talk about the old times. And
Now, we've talked about how Wellington Rankin was independent of the Anaconda Company.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any stories or anything that come to your mind about any row he might have had with them or any relationship he might have had with them?
He had some bad cases against them, portal suit and things like that. I don't know exactly what they were. Years before I knew him, but that's where he got in bed with him, because he was very successful in bringing lawsuits for the injured workmen against them.
Oh, I see. So he did some workers' comp work, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. learned it under
Walsh.
Walsh, yeah.
Yeah, really. Well, that is most interesting.
Yeah, workman's comp was his great suit early, and it was kind of a new thing in Montana. And he put it to good use, and of course it didn't end up with the company.
Before we leave the subject of Walsh, I might have asked you this. I can't remember if I asked you this directly or not. Do you remember Wellington Rankin ever discussing Walsh with you? I mean, aside from the interesting case about, you know, Colonel Nolan, in effect, telling Tommy Cruise's daughter that it was okay to marry that guy. Do you remember any other stories or any descriptions or anything that Wellington Rankin
did? His wife was kind of the office manager, kept the time book.
Walsh's wife was?
Yes. And every day she put a list of things on his desk, things coming up, you know, to keep him in tune and stuff. She'd send out all the bills and everything. And he said, in those days, people would come by and want money for different projects like they do today. She'd knock at the door. And Wellington, for a while, they had a corner of his main room, I think. And she'd say, so-and-so's here. I'm sure they want a contribution for such and such. He wouldn't look up in his book card. He'd write him a check, give him so-and-so. Don't let him in. Don't let him in. Give him a check and get rid of him. And then he said they'd go to Nolan. He'd say, come in. And he'd spend 30, 40 minutes shooting the breeze with them and giving a little tiny check or no check at all.
Really?
Yeah. That was the difference of the two men he told men to him.
That is interesting, mm-hmm. too, isn't it? Because, but I guess I've seen photographs of Walsh, but mm-hmm. Walsh looks like he would be a no-nonsense kind of a guy.
He was.
That's kind of how his photograph makes him appear. And a very partisan Democrat, from mm-hmm. what I've read. Mm-hmm. Not just a nominal Democrat,
well,
but a partisan Democrat.
They made him chairman of one of the Democrat conventions, you know,
yeah.
National Convention.
Chairman of one of the Democratic National Convention.
But he didn't have a real good voice.
Yeah.
The voice was Nolan's.
Oh, yeah.
Roland thought the world of Walsh.
Some respected him greatly, obviously.
You bet.
Yeah. Now, the governor during the 1920s, mm-hmm. when a lot of this stuff was going on, was Johnny Erickson, who we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. And of course, his resignation led to Frank Cooney becoming governor and the impeachment mm-hmm. proceeding that both your fathers were involved in when they were mm-hmm. members of the legislature. Any recollections at all about Erickson, or any, I mean, recollections that maybe Wellington Rankin would have shared with you?
No, not that time.
Not that memorable of a person.
I remember my father talking about it because he was there the time they voted to impeach him. But tough.
Then the governor who, did you ever meet Frank Cooney, either one of you?
No.
Did you ever meet Roy Ayers?
Oh, yes.
What do you remember about him, Jack? He was governor, I think, from about 1936 to 1940.
He was a drunk.
I met him, and I don't know why. I imagine it was through my father, but
yeah.
There was a newspaper from up north called the Pink Reporter. And Dad was clerk of court when Ayers was judge. And they didn't get along at all.
Your dad, Bert Replogle, was clerk of court in
when he studied law.
Fergus County.
Clerk of court, yeah. He had a homestead and he couldn't work it because it was just too crippled from the war.
I want to add a little more when she gets through.
Good.
Anyway, there was some elderly woman and Ayers was drunk or something. He ran over with a car. Wouldn't do a darn thing for her.
Who ran over with the car?
Ayers.
The governor?
He hit it with the car. Well, he was governor at the time.
Oh, I see.
Well, this went on for some time, then Dad brought a suit against him. And he went to the bank one day, and here came the governor. He never came to anybody except a county patrolman guarding him and stuff. And he walked up to Dad, and he said, "Well, you peg-legged old son of a bitch, you sued me, didn't you?" And Dad turned around and just knocked him down.
That's what I was going to say.
And this newspaper had it all over the state and everything.
This was before Roy Ayers was governor.
No, he was governor at the time.
He was governor at the mm-hmm. time, and your dad decked the governor.
He decked him, yeah.
In the bank.
In the bank.
But people in the bank thought it was great. At least, remember, not Tom Baker was a teller there.
Yeah.
He even told me about it one time. Well, really cold cocked him.
Well, I imagine that made quite an impression.
And then the highway patrolman had picked him up, and then the others held Daddy back. But
Your dad would have put him down the second time, huh?
Well, if he could. He didn't lose his balance. He had an artificial leg.
I remember, her father, Bert Replogle, was the most wounded fellow out of Montana in the First World War. He had his leg shot off. He'd been gassed. He was...
Lost two fingers and a thumb. Lost,
he was the most wounded fellow out of Montana in the First World War.
Yeah. He was nominated in by fact, Dixon buried, at the veterans at the entombment of the unknown soldier.
Governor Joe Dixon nominated him to present to be present at the tomb of the unknown soldier when it was dedicated.
There were two or three of them. He represented the veterans. Chief Plenty, who represented all the Indian tribe, but that was the presidential appointment, not a governor's one.
Yeah.
And that's where he got to know Chief Plenty.
Yeah. But, do you remember Rankin ever saying anything about Dixon?
Yes. He had some campaign stuff at Dixon. These old, there's a picture of his three or four daughters. What do you call them? These black kind of glassy picture, just instead of negatives, they were, I forget what they were. He had some of those, and it said on the bottom, Dixon's answer to the charge he kept his sons out of war.
All he had was daughters. Yeah. That was pretty good. You still have those? Someplace?
I think we gave them to the Historic Society. I gave them what few things I had when we moved the one office. But engraver. I didn't either. Fellow engraver. But he never did talk much about the fight he had with them. I'm sure they fought on a lot of things, too.
Well, he was Attorney General when Dixon was governor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Jules Carlin book, you know, they started out as allies, and then Dixon ended up appointing him to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't mortal enemies, but they also, I think they were two strong-willed men who had their disagreements, was the long and short
but
of it.
He admired Dixon's stand against companies and stuff and all of that. But Charlie Cooper, Gary Cooper's father, didn't run. No, he quit. Some relative of his died, and he was wanted to handle his estate. Cooper never had a dime or anything, and he left and went to California. And Dixon appointed Wellington in his place.
And did your father know Charles Cooper?
I think so.
And I wonder why Wellington wanted to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, he was Attorney General at the time, wasn't he? Didn't he have to resign as Attorney General?
Yes. His term was about up, I think, but I'm not sure how that worked. You'd have to look it up here.
Yeah.
See how much term was left. But he didn't like the court and said it was a graveyard.
Yeah.
Wasn't active enough.
I've read that someplace, or maybe you've told me that in another conversation that he was bored with being on the Supreme Court. Let's make sure our recorder's working here. Heard it make it. No, it's still working. It made a funny sound there, or at least I thought it did. So the triumvirate was former Attorney General and Governor Sam Ford.
Mm-hmm.
It was Wellington D. Rankin, who I think might have been the Republican National Committee man of the Montana Republican Party at the time.
Well, either that or later.
And it was
he was never head of the Republican Party, and that fellow Steele said that. What's his name?
Well, he was the Republican National Committee man.
He was never chairman of the Republican Party.
Yeah, okay. And then Burton K. Wheeler, who of course was a U.S. Mm-hmm. Senator.
Mm-hmm.
How did Wheeler get involved in that kind of a situation? Do you know?
You mean friends with them?
Yeah.
Well, they're all young lawyers coming out to Montana about the same time, early in the century.
Yeah.
And they liked each other.
I see.
Had cases against each other, worked together. And they were all strong-willed, and they were all fought by the company.
Yeah.
All three of them.
Now,
I remember when Wheeler was charged and indicted with, what was it, fraud or something with the company. And Wellington submitted my name on the street one day, and he said, well, what are you doing here? Oh, he said, you know, I'm indicted, I have to go up to court here. He says, for a hearing? Yes, he said. Well, he says, where's your lawyer? I'm my lawyer. And nobody with you? No, I'll go with you. He went up and sat through the whole thing with him. Here he was, all alone, facing it up. It was a bogus charge, and he was acquitted.
Who was this that was charged?
Wheeler.
Wasn't Wheeler a lawyer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, but who was...
He was in the Senate at this time.
Yeah.
But the company had some kind of a charge against him.
Against Wheeler.
Against Wheeler, yeah. And
okay, you said that wrong. You made a mistake. You said that Wheeler wasn't a lawyer one time in it.
Well, at least I misunderstood.
He didn't have a lawyer with him.
Had no lawyer with him, I see.
Okay.
Even though he was a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I got you.
So Mr. Rankin went with...
Now, of course, right during this same period of time, Wellington Rankin's sister Jeanette cast the sole vote in the U.S. Senate against World War II. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet her?
Oh my goodness, she lived with us every summer. Not every summer, a couple of summers she was in India.
You know, I was actually serving in the state legislature mm-hmm. before her death. Mm-hmm. And when I was in the Navy, I was back in Washington, D.C., and I think she spent some time back there. I don't know for sure. But I regret that I never met her. You know, I had a lengthy conversation with Senator B.K. Wheeler, at a, you know, I think 1971 yeah. or 1972, but I missed meeting her. How would you describe her? I mean, if you were trying to describe her to me, someone who had
very
never met her.
Very strong-minded. Of course, must do all the talking, most women do. These kids met her. She lived at our house for a time. After Jack and I were married, I think it was two or three times she came by. Interested in the future, and I didn't want to talk about the past much. Worried about the country, worried about the young people.
Very philosophical, issue-oriented.
Yeah.
Was she, would you, if you didn't know, would you think that she and Wellington were brother and sister? Were they alike? Were they similar?
They were alike in that they were both very strong-willed. They were not alike in their thinking. They, I remember when she'd been to India and then went on down to Africa when she visited the diamond mines. And she was telling us one night after dinner about the poor colored people. Their husbands go in there and they're fine with a week or 2 weeks without coming up. And of course the money runs out and the people don't have nothing to eat. So the British issue them what's called a mealie. And what's that? Well, that's kind of a grain mixture, this and that. And finally he looked up kind of bored and he said, well, he said, they make bread, don't they? Oh no, they don't know how to make bread. Well, he said, don't know how to make bread. Don't know how to make bread. Why, the most uncivilized people of all times could make bread. They ought to be locked up. She stood up, stiff as a rod, marched to the door, went to her room. Next morning, just find everything was said, but... But that's the difference in the two of them.
Yeah. He was more traditional in his outlook, and she was more...
Right. She hated the British.
Yeah.
It's because probably of their...
It seems like she would have been a pretty unusual Republican, that she would have been not a very typical Republican. Is that fair?
Kind of an independent Republican.
Yeah.
She'd go her own way.
Yeah.
Their imperialisms, I think, why she turned on the British.
Now, Jack, you obviously met her, too.
Yes.
If you were just describing her, how would you? Would you?
A very kind, erudite, very intelligent lady, even in her old age, and very kind lady.
I
never had a real serious conversation with her, but she was a very nice lady.
Now, the war vote, of course, was a big thing. Mm-hmm. And I think Wellington Rankin ran for the U.S. Senate in 1942. Well,
I don't know.
I think you gave me a campaign poster. Somebody did that. It was 1942 U.S. Senate, and he was his slogan was something about
preparedness
or defeat the Axis powers or something or other like that. But it wasn't a pacifist kind of a thing.
No.
And it made me wonder, you know. Whether her vote against World War II must not have created some major difficulties for him.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
It must have.
Yeah, but...
Because my guess is that if he'd been in Congress, he probably wouldn't have voted that.
No, he wouldn't. He's more of a hawk, he's more of a dove.
Yeah.
She was a pacifist all of her life.
Yeah. Now, she was replaced in the U.S. Senate by Mansfield. In the U.S. House by Mansfield. She served the term from 1940 to 1942, and then Mansfield went into the House of Representatives. Senator Mike Mansfield, who was then a representative at that time, and of course I met Mansfield on more than one occasion and had an opportunity to visit with him, and I suppose both of you probably did too. Any impressions of him, Jack?
Very, very likable, intelligent, strong man.
He was my professor in the university.
He was. You had him as a professor at the University of Missoula?
Yeah, that's why I'm wondering about the date. It couldn't have been my freshman year because I started in 41.
Well, I think he was elected to the U.S. House in 1942.
Well, let's see. 1942.
I think Jeanette replaced Jacob Torkelson, I think, in 1940. And she was just...
That's Philip. First district. Jim O'Connor, the second district. Then she'll be Tazel Baker, and O'Connor will be Fritz Haynes.
1942, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Was he a good teacher?
Yes, good speaker. It was all talking, lecturing. Good lecturer. Easy to take notes from. And
clear, simple sentences, I would guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you'd take a test, and that's it.
Yeah.
He would open for discussion if anybody wanted it. But
Louise, we have to mention Senator Mansfield when he was ambassador to Japan, and we stopped in there shortly.
Yes.
After. Go ahead.
We took this trip.
Yeah,
that's the one that the Morrisons.
Yeah, Judge Morrison.
Yeah, for lawyers and stuff. And on the way back, we stopped in Japan and met with Mansfield. It was after they shot down a Korean plane.
Oh, yeah.
Same time.
Yeah. Congressman Larry McDonald, I think, was on the plane.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And who was it that shot it down? The Chinese or the North Koreans? Or
Chinese.
Well, I forget. Anyway,
it was a passenger plane.
Yeah.
Very controversial. Yeah. People wondered why they felt they needed to do that. Right. It had strayed off course over their airspace or something.
Yeah, got into their airspace.
So you were in Japan right not long after that incident had occurred.
Not long after. In fact, we debated about going. And the Morrison called somebody back in D.C. and they said, go ahead and go. Well, then Karen on the trip was blaming the...
Sharon Morrison?
Sharon, yeah.
Frank Morrison's wife.
Wife. Yeah. She was blaming the pilot of the plane and everything.
She was blaming the United States.
Sit right there on the plane. Do not veer into other territory. She just excused them and all. So when we got to Mansfield, I said, he gave a speech and told how terrible this was. And I said, let's go up and talk to him. I thought, tell him what you think. It's your opinion. Oh, we shouldn't bother him. She said, well, I wanted to do that, you know. Because he was all the other ways.
But she was very protective of the Red Chinese.
You bet,
yeah.
You bet.
Yeah.
Just excusing him.
I just wanted to get that in.
Yeah, well. So you met Mansfield there when you were in Japan as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the governor of Montana in the 1950s was J. Hugo Aronson.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of my first important political memories was of him, and I had an opportunity to meet him a time or two. Any thoughts or impressions about him from either one of you?
I remember shortly after getting out of the Army, going to a stockbroker's meeting in Butte, I think it was either Butte or Helena, and my dad and Hugo Aronson were sitting in a booth, and my dad called me over and introduced me to the next governor of the state of Montana. Thought that I knew that he was going to be
sure.
Or anything, but he was evidently talked into running.
And your dad was part of a group of guys that apparently were working on him to run at that time.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Louise, did you ever meet him or form any impressions of him?
Well, we went to different meetings where he went with us when William was national committeeman and he was governor. Mm. And like everybody liked him. He was a big honest Swede.
Yeah.
Played it to the hilt.
Very easygoing.
Very easygoing.
Yeah.
I remember, he always had a good line bringing the people down. Somebody asked him one time, they said, Governor, how many people are working at the Capitol? About half of them. Things like that. He had a good sense of humor.
He was definitely a common self-made man.
Absolutely.
I suppose that shown. I remember. I remember he had large hands. In an easygoing manner, that sort of thing.
Yeah, he said for the first months or maybe a year or so when he first came to this country, he just lived on ham and eggs because that's all he could say.
Yeah. When you go into a restaurant, they ask him, he could say ham and eggs, and he got pretty sick of ham and eggs.
Yeah, right.
wish he could have learned how to say, I want what he's having, huh? Or something like that, even if he couldn't read the menu. Would you have any recollections of him as governor? I mean, anything about him as governor that would stand out in your mind?
I can't remember. Can you, Jack?
Well, I was buying some land from the state for people that I was working for at the time, and I remember that when I finally came down to the board meeting, and by that time the governor said, well, we'll sell Mr. Gold any land he wants. And Forrest Anderson said, well, no, let's don't do that. He was a good governor and a kind man.
That was a meeting of the state land board.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the attorney general at the time, Forrest Anderson, was a member of the land board.
Yes.
And when you came before him and wanted to buy some state land.
And strangely enough, Mr. Rankin was the one that sent me up to, prior to this, sent me up to Forrest Anderson to talk to him, and Forrest Anderson just scraped me over the coals, and so I finally got up and said, this was just prior to the meeting. And I said, well, hell, I'm not going into that meeting if you feel like that. And he said, God damn it, no, you, Forrest Anderson, said, you come on into that meeting. And he was the one that, I misquoted myself, Forrest Anderson was the one that made the motion that I could buy anything that I wanted, and it was the governor that said, no, we'll put restrictions on that.
I had that
turned around. It was sort of...
Why would Anderson have treated you the way he did in that meeting and then changed like that? Do you have any idea?
Just part of his disposition.
Yeah, he kind of a contrary cuss in some respects.
Yeah, and let you know who the hell was boss.
But still, he treated you fairly, you felt, when the time came?
Yeah. But he wanted to impress me on who the hell was boss.
Any other impressions of Forrest Anderson? He later, of course, went on to become governor.
Yes.
And when you and I served in the House of Representatives, he was governor.
That's right, yeah. And I had several meetings with him, and they were always pleasant.
Yeah.
Never agreed with his politics. But
would you describe him as frank, direct, strong leader?
No, I would describe him as devious and political.
Louise, do you have any thoughts or impressions on Forrest Anderson?
I liked him very much. Huh? He's the one that appointed me to the Board of Regents. Republican member.
That's what I mean. He's devious.
Yeah. But you always rely on him.
Yeah. He was both Attorney General and Governor. You were practicing attorney when he was Attorney General.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And Wellington Rankin was alive while he was Attorney General too, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
But he had died.
Wellington Rankin and him were great friends. I don't know whether great friends, but
yeah.
I was sitting in the office when Mr. Rankin called the Attorney General, Forrest Anderson, and Mr. Anderson said, Mr. Rankin said he wanted me to go speak to him. And I mean, he told the Attorney General that he wanted him to speak to me.
So. I see. He made the appointment for
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah.
They used to talk lengthy conversations on the phone about different politics and political situations, sounding each other out and giving stuff back and forth and just talking politics. They
sure
both loved it.
They both loved politics.
I remember one day, Wilson walked into the library just as the phone rang. It was right by the secretary's desk. And the other two over here. And Mr. Avery was dictating, and it was Forrest Anderson. Well, he sat there, must have been 20 minutes talking, and all the work stopped. Everybody was sitting there like this, you know. And finally he says, well, Forrest, we'll have to have a visit sometime. And Mr. Avery, who never says a word, went, huh.
What was that if it wasn't a visit?
Huh? Yeah.
And Mr. Avery was Arthur Avery, who was Wellington's partner in the law firm there.
Partner? Is that the word?
Associate.
They were in the same law firm,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that. Okay. So, any impressions of I've asked you if your parents, either one of them, shared any impressions about the Anaconda Company with you. And we've talked a little bit about that, and I'd give you an mm-hmm. opportunity to say more about that now if you want to, or anything you can remember from your own experience with the Anaconda Company.
You mentioned Hoover. I can't think of the
other. Harold Hoover was an officer for the Anaconda Company and a lawyer in Great Falls.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it ended up being president of the Anaconda Company.
I know a cute story about them, too. I forget who the other one was. Hoover and some other lawyer. Some fellow lost a bunch of horses, and they sued the company. I think it was from the smelter, a fumes from the smelter that did that to the horses. And Hoover was on representing the company, of course, and he was representing this poor rancher. And he said, in those days, he didn't know too much about viruses and bugs and stuff. Our side had one vet. They had three. And the first two testified that this bug virus, I guess, had never been isolated. And that was till all three of them testified that. So anyway, the third one came in, and he got there late and hadn't heard the other testimony, and he got up there and went on and on and kind of got the idea. He didn't know what he was talking about. So we asked him to step down a minute, come over here to the black. Did you draw us a picture of this one? And Hoover jumped up and started objecting. Malone got in front of him and was waving this fellow on, and the fellow had his back turned and didn't get the commotion. By the time the judge got him quiet, he'd drawn a picture of this bug and stood back to display his thing. And Malone was able to argue that once again, history's been made in the little town of Fort Benton. You know, it'll ring out through all the world tomorrow that this influenza bug has been isolated. But Hoover was kind of cute. He says, well, he said, a lawyer ought to have the right to carry a gun. And when you get a dumb son of a bitch like that in the stand, just use your gun and say, I call the next witness. So he had a good sense of humor, too. But they got along real well. Now, he fought the Anaconda Company, but got along well with the lawyers. And so.
Now, he didn't always get along well with Will Campbell, who was the editor of the Helen Independent Record, which is a paper owned by the Anaconda Company. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about that relationship?
Just what he told me about the speech he made at the theater, that when the Anaconda Company tells Montana women how to name their children, they've gone too far. But he was very critical of Wellington, Wheeler, Judge...
Tell the story again about the Montana women naming their children.
Well, Campbell had gone after him in the paper. Vicious.
Campbell had gone after Wellington Rankin.
I don't know what all he said. I never did hear that. And then Wellington was due to speak at this theater, the Marlowe Theater, I guess.
The old Marlowe Theater in Helena.
I think it was old Marlowe.
What?
And in the course of his speech, he mentioned this. He'd ridiculed him for using the name Wellington, you know, English name and this and that, and the boy from Oxford and all this and that. And so when he spoke, he said, Campbell said this and this and this. And the ladies and gentlemen, he said, my father was hit by something, a cannonball or something, early days in Missoula, and they thought he almost died, but this doctor, whose name was Wellington so-and-so, brought him around. And that was short before Wellington was born, so she named him Wellington. And he told them that. And then he said, when he got through telling how he got the name, he said, ladies and gentlemen, when the Anaconda Copper Mining Company starts telling the women of Montana how they can name their children, they've gone too far.
And he said that because it was commonly known that the Helen Independent was owned by the Anaconda Company.
Yeah, you bet. So he wanted to make it known, too.
Sure, and so when Will Campbell, the editor, is attacking him, he was establishing that connection.
Now, who was the judge? Federal judge.
Berquin?
Berquin, yes. He attacked him all the time, too.
Campbell attacked Berquin all the time, yeah.
And Ford, too, over the First World War stuff, they weren't tight hard enough on the Germans.
Oh.
And Berkeley didn't give a damn. He had to go by the Constitution, you know.
Yeah.
Because the person that the German didn't mean he was a...
And Montana passed an act in our legislature.
Yeah.
In a special session in 1918, I think, that was pretty tough. In fact, Congress then adopted a similar act, as I understand it. So Will Campbell obviously would have been in favor of that. Mm-hmm. And
then he was on some committee. And Ford, I think Ford was...
Liberty League, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But Ford got rid of it, and with that, nothing to do with it after that.
When Ford was Attorney General, he got rid of it. Is that probably right?
I don't think he was Attorney General yet. I think he was young. I'm not sure of that. I have that in the book somewhere.
Okay. When I first got to the legislature, the Anaconda Company had moved from their old watering hole. They had a watering hole in, I think, the sixth floor or something of the Placer Hotel building. Mm-hmm. And they were still an important presence in the legislature, but I never really thought they were a dominating one, but maybe I didn't realize the influence they had. Jack, when you got to the legislature, did you have any impression of them, their lobbyists?
Well, I certainly knew their lobbyists.
Lloyd Crippen?
Yeah.
How would you describe him and his influence?
I think he was a well-respected lobbyist. I never knew him to really crowd anyone, to low-key, and perhaps very effective.
Congenial?
Very.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Do you remember, did you ever know Al Wilkinson?
Yes.
I never met him. He was, I don't think he was still in the picture when we got there, was he?
No, I don't think so. I met him when back in the
40s or 50s or something, maybe?
Yes.
How would you have met him? Do you remember anything about that?
Well, through my dad, I'm sure it was. Yeah. And he was a very sociable, very kind, very typical, there was a typical lobbyist. And what, he spent his career, part of it, back in Washington.
Back in Washington, D.C., yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
Oh, yes, several times.
And who, his wife, his daughter was Lloyd's...
Yeah, Lois Crippen was Wilkinson's daughter, I think. Yeah, that's right.
Daughter and son. Met him several times, and then I know when Wellington died, I came back in the plane. He had stopped in Butte for a few minutes. He came up and got on the plane and put his arms around me for a while.
Huh.
Close friend.
How would you describe him? Because I guess when we talk about the influence of the Anaconda Company in Montana, in some of my other interviews, the name Wilkinson has come up as someone who, if the Anaconda Company was ever a really powerful and important presence in Montana, it might have been during the period when Al Wilkinson was maybe the kind of the leading figure in their political operation. And I guess I'm just curious to know your impressions of that, whether you think that's true, and if so...
I think he was their top lobbyist, and they counted on him for...
But he was hired by other people, you know. He was always a hired gun. He never set the policy. The policy was set by...
Yeah.
And later, when it was set by New York, the top people were no longer Montanans. That made a difference, too.
Yeah.
They relied on him. He was affable and likable and...
If I asked you to describe or to identify the five most influential people in Montana in the 1950s, would he be on your list?
Well, I wouldn't have known that in the 1950s.
It wasn't obvious.
Not to me. Well, in 1950. Yeah.
Just trying to think of, because the Anaconda Company was still a huge economic influence in the 1950s. They were maybe beginning to decline somewhat in the 60s. And then the 70s, they were certainly not as powerful as they had been before then. So the reason I ask you about that is in the 50s, Wilkinson was still very much a presence in the Anaconda Company, and they were still very much a big presence in Montana. And so I just wondered how noticeable that was to you. If you as county attorney in Fergus County, probably wouldn't have been in a position to have known much about that.
Ford, I knew.
Yeah.
And I was just a cowboy. I never knew nothing.
So you wouldn't have.
Either one was.
You wouldn't have, if I asked you to identify the five most influential people in Montana, Wilkinson would probably not have been on your list. What, say in 1950s?
No.
Yeah.
But then, remember my ignorance.
Well, and you weren't as involved in politics. Okay, so then when you arrived in the legislature in the early 1970s. Would the lead lobbyist for the Anaconda Company then was it Crippen?
Crippen. Yeah.
And there was Denny Shea, there was a guy named Glenn Kearney, Largy McDonald, I think, was there lobbying for him for a little while.
Yeah.
If I asked you, since Crippen was the lead lobbyist, maybe it's the best way to phrase the question is that way, would you have placed him on the list of the most influential people in Montana when we were legislators?
I would think he had a, I think he was a very effective and capable lobbyist, but I'd never put him into a place where he had much power in the state of Montana.
You wouldn't consider him a controlling influence?
No, I would not.
How would you describe his influence? I mean,
A very capable agent of his interests, but
not
a very capable lobbyist, but not of not any political powerhouse.
In your recollection, were there other lobbyists that you think might have been comparable in influence to him, or?
I'm sure there are, but I can't tell you their names right now. I just can't think. Crippen, a very good friend, and I really respected him, but I never thought he was any big hammer like Wilkinson probably was prior.
Would you, I know it's an apples and oranges kind of a thing, but there were some other important lobbyists during that period of time. Jim Murray for the AFL-CIO.
And I would think he'd be, at that time in the 70s, I think he probably had more influence in the legislature than Floyd Crippen did.
Yeah.
Or Lloyd Crippen.
Yeah.
You're talking about leaders in as lobbyists in the legislature.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we're talking about lobbyists. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other lobbyists come to your mind? John Lahr? Representing the Montana Power Company? Everett Shuey representing the Montana Power Company?
I would think was a very, very good lobbyist. Did it low key, not out in front, but very effective.
Any farm organization lobbyist that you can remember from that period?
Oh, probably, who's our friend from Montana Stockers?
Mons Tegan.
Yeah. Mons Tegan had some influence then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And his organization had some influence then.
And he represented the Montana Stock Growers Association.
That's right.
The Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, I don't know if...
both of them certainly had a presence.
But with that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Jack, but I think what you're telling me is that you didn't regard the Anaconda Company or probably any particular group or organization, business entity or otherwise, as having a really controlling influence over the legislature when we were there. There were several that had some influence.
You quoted it very well.
Okay.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
But you responded too when I mentioned Jim Murray, who represented the AFL-CIO, as thinking that he might, at least during some periods of time during the 1970s, might have had pretty great influence, maybe greater influence than some of these other guys we're talking
about.
That's
right. True.
Who was your education lobbyist? They were...
D. Cooper.
And I don't even remember him.
He represented the Montana Education Association.
I remember the name, but I can't place him right now.
Yeah.
So he's not as... was not as effective to me as, say, Jim Murray, who I remember very, very well.
Did Jim ever lobby you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a couple of them.
Because, you know, you wouldn't be someone that would be a very easy mark for him, I would think.
Right.
You represented a district that would have had very few union members, and your philosophy wouldn't necessarily have been close to his.
Not very. But I respected him, and evidently I think he respected me in a way.
You remember having a cordial relationship with him? Yeah. Now, Louise, you weren't a legislator, of course, at the time. Do you have any impression about any of these lobbyists that we're talking about, or... Any of this kind of business at all?
Nope.
Having not been a legislator, this might be an interesting question to begin with you. Just be interested in your thoughts and impressions of any legislators, any time in your life, any Montana legislators. Were there any that, for whatever reason, kind of stand out in your mind in any decade?
Who's the one
outside of me?
Who's the one from Winnett?
Pardon?
Who's that one from Winnett? I'm trying to get Billy Quiddell on as a page.
Oh.
In the past history, you did, and Louise forgot to mention, that back in the early days, in the, she was also the national chairman of the Young Republicans.
Louise was national chairman for the whole country of the Young Republicans.
That's right, yeah.
Co-chairman, there were two of us, man and woman.
When was that?
In the 50s.
51, 48 to 51, something like
so
that.
So you weren't when Eisenhower was president?
When she was county, she was county attorney, she was also.
I see.
I think 48 and 50, but I'm not sure.
Did you ever meet Senator Robert Taft?
No.
You had meetings in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. I suppose?
They put me on the executive board of the National Committee. There were about 15, 20 of us, and I had to go back to the meeting.
Wow, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Who was the Republican National Chairman then?
There were two. The second one was from Pennsylvania, Scott.
Hugh Scott, yeah.
And I forget who the other one was.
He later was the U.S. Senate Minority Leader.
Okay.
Yeah, Senator Hugh Scott from Pennsylvania in the 1960s.
What was I thinking of the first one?
I meant to break in and tell you that.
I'm glad you did, because I didn't. I don't remember that I ever knew that, in fact.
Well, they had the convention, and I don't know how my name came up. But the National asked me to run, and Frank Whetstone sent, or Dan Whetstone's committee man, he sent his kid, Dan.
Yeah.
Duart sent a man from his office.
Ford's, Congressman Wes Duart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Governor Ford sent his daughter Shirley, married to Ted James, and the Bill Scott from Great Falls. And
Ted James later became Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah. A fellow named Junkemeyer from Great Falls. And then Billings was Fred Moulton, who just recently died. And another fellow became a judge. Can't think of his name. He died long ago. We had quite a good group. And then Paul Jewell, Missoula. I'm surprised to see him there. I don't know how he got there. But we got down there. And,
down where?
Salt Lake. And they had, the big deal was a fellow from California named Lachlan Waters. He was going to be the new chairman. Well, you wouldn't have a chairman and co-chairman in the same part of the country. That was the old bugaboo. Well, they had no woman really of any to be considered too much. So we had the time of our lives. We didn't have. They had champagne parties and everything, some of these big states, for their candidates. We had nothing. But these few people that went around room to room, you know, delegation to delegation. And boy, at the time the voting came, we had them all calling us to run with us. It was young Philip Wilkie was the last one to call. He decided he
Wendell Wilkie's son?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we met him.
And he wanted you to run
with him, yeah.
I see. And because and you, as a county attorney,
mm-hmm.
you had an important credential. It was unusual for a woman, right. And that's kind of a situation.
Yes. You know, I never thought of it as being terribly unusual until he got down there. Everybody couldn't believe it, you know.
Yeah.
But.
So you ended up running with who?
A fellow named Tolt from Ohio. And he never did much or anything, but. They couldn't agree on the others, one that part of the state, and I wouldn't run with anybody. We finally decided we'd just run on our own, not tie up with anybody, and they had several ballots, and California was furious. They'd spent all this money and all these parties. And
you weren't a good fit with the guy from California,
no,
because you were too
west,
both
yeah.
from the West, yeah.
But that was fine.
Yeah, I'll bet that was interesting.
Yeah, they had fun out of it.
Jack, let me ask you about legislators that you served with. Are there any that particularly stand out in your mind?
A fellow, bald-headed old fellow from up west, Bob Brown.
well, thank you, and I appreciate that. But you, was Jim Lucas speaker?
You bet. He's one of if you asked me, no, he wasn't speaker yeah. when I was there.
Well, he was still in the House anyway when
yes,
we were there.
Yes,
yeah.
And he was the minority leader. Yes, he was very impressive. The impressive legislator, Gene Turney, Jim Lucas, was the impressed me the most.
And how were they alike? Or how were they different? They both impressed you.
That they impressed me, yes. Knowledgeable, smart.
But they're
very good on their feet.
Good on their feet, both of them good on their feet, yeah. Good debaters.
Yeah. And knew what the hell they were talking about.
Yeah. Well, that can be pretty important too.
Did George O'Connor there then?
No, George O'Connor was there, I think, in the 50s, and he went on to become the president of the Montana Power Company? I think he did.
The Montana Power Company, I don't think he was president.
Did you, Louise, did you ever meet George O'Connor?
Oh, yeah. Because I knew his wife, though.
I didn't really, I heard his trademark was a red necktie.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had been a legislator, I think, from Stillwater County, perhaps. Fromberg, I believe, was his hometown.
Some little town, I mean.
Some little town over there.
Yeah.
And he ended up as Speaker of the House at one time, and he was known for his mastery of the rules. Apparently he was a wonderful expert in legislative rules. Mm-hmm. And then he continued to be a lobbyist for the Montana Power Company after he left the legislature. But because he knew the rules so well, he continued to be an important influence, maybe for that and other reasons afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I never met him, and I never knew him at all. I heard his trademark was a red necktie. That
right.
You remember that about him?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about meeting him ever? Or?
Oh, yes. Met him several times. I knew his wife well. He married a girl. She was a reporter for the paper. Viola Goff.
Okay. Newell Goff's daughter?
No, spelled differently.
I see.
She was Barbara. Tress Sears' wife's cousin.
I see.
So,
okay. So, Jack, you were especially impressed by Jim Lucas and Gene Turnage. Was there a Democrat that stands out in your mind? Did you ever serve with a Democrat legislator that might have made any kind of a particular impression on you?
Who was that fella? And he was. Remember, you were in the house with me that night that Jim Lucas and that...
John Hall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell about that.
Well, just he was a very articulate...
Well, what were they debating?
Something about coal, weren't they?
Yeah, what I remember was I think Representative Dorothy Bradley, who was the only woman in the house at the time, had introduced a bill to place a moratorium on the mining of coal.
Yeah, something like
till we could get further into it and understand it better, something like that. And so a lot of the guys were in favor of economic development and saw this as an opportunity.
Yeah.
And the spokesperson for that group was Jim Lucas.
Yeah.
And John Hall was the spokesperson for the group that said, I remember one of the lines he used in the debate was, act in haste, repent at leisure, was one of the lines that Hall used.
Yeah.
And but this was a... How do you remember it then? It was a night debate.
That's right.
In the House
night
of Representatives.
In the House of Representatives. It impressed me. Two articulate people with strong convictions, expressing themselves.
Well, you're
very
not
well.
The only guy that remembers that. In many cases, is the most memorable. It was, you know, I've heard it likened to the Webster and Hain debate. You know, in the U.S. Senate. None of us, of course, ever were around to knowing about that. But it was there were two powerfully effective orators, well prepared and brilliant and articulate, and you could hear a pin drop in that place. I remember while they spoke. So that was an impressive experience. I know it was. Yeah. Were you there? Do you remember also another night session when there was an attempt to censor some Republican legislators who were members of what we called the Legislative Campaign Committee, and the Democrats felt that we'd broken the law, and so there was a sort of a censorship hearing that was held in the House chamber at night. Do you remember that?
I don't remember, but I remember the problem. Louise, is that what you were looking for earlier on the floor there, that medicine bottle?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Well, what I remember about that was that a representative from Billings, a lawyer representative by the name of Tom Tao, was involved in bringing that action.
Yeah.
And of course, you and I served with Tom Tow both in the House and Senate. Any thoughts or impressions of Tom Tow?
He was a very capable fellow who never knew what the hell he was talking about half the time. But he expressed himself very well.
Yeah.
He did a lot of talking, but I don't ever think he was very persuasive.
We always knew that if there was any very complex kind of legislation on the floor, Tom Tow almost always had an amendment, didn't he?
That always.
And he gave lots of talks about a lot of things, and maybe because he had so many opinions about so many things, he watered down his influence, I think. Would you agree? I would think so.
Yeah. That's my impression anyway. Yeah. You always expected him to get up and talk, but pretty soon it got to go ahead and let him talk.
Louise, did you have any impressions of Tom Tow? I saw you react when I mentioned his name.
The only impression I had was a lawsuit I had with him. His father had a feedlot in Roundup, and we feed cattle every, those years we did, every year in the winter. And this winter we put ours in his feedlot. Well, we had a contract that they couldn't go over such and such a weight, or we'd have to take them out. Well, anyway, we went down to take them out, and Jack and Mr. Aker went down and weighed them and everything and settled up. And in doing so, they cut back about 30 head, was it? That were too fat to go to grass and should go to market, but the Billings market wasn't open for almost a week. So anyway, off they went. Then the next, when the week came to get the cattle, Tom Tow had told him not to let him take them. There was a mistake on the bill, the settlement, and we owed him $3,000. So Jack called me, what will I do? The trucks are here to get the cattle, and this is what they tell us. So I called him.
You called Tow?
Tow, in Billings. And he said, well, he said, just send me your check for I said, you know, Tom, if there's a mistake, we make it good. But we got to sit down and go over this. We can't hold these trucks here and these cattle and so on and so forth. And well, he said, you just send me your check and I'll just hold it until we meet and go over this thing. And I said, no, that $3,000 is good in my desk as it is yours. And I wouldn't do it. And he went on just adamant, you know, they're going to hold these cattle. And finally I said, all right, you're holding about $30,000 worth of cattle for what you claim was a $3,000 bill, and you just do that at your own risk, and hung up on him. Then he called and told him to leave all but 10 go. Well, we didn't bother about the 10, so later we brought suit and we plevin to get the cattle back. And I think Aker went down there on the suit, put up a bond to get the cattle and take them to market. And so he came out and put a contrary bond to hold them. Well, anyway, and it went on for, what, 2 years? A little over? Uh-huh. And the last time we had a hearing...
Those cows must have been the oldest cows in Montana by that time. Huh?
Well, I think they were steers. The great big things. When we had the last hearing, I think it was summary judgment, and the judge ruled in our favor, and the lawyer in Tom's firm said to me, I said to him, why does he want to hold these cattle? He says, we don't know. They're the only cattle in the whole damn feedlot. His father has no one to buy feed for him, but a man to feed him. And he said, we spent more money on these cattle than the $3,000. And he said, we don't understand it. And he says, it's my ace in the hole. It's my ace in the hole. Well, finally, we won the whole suit, and that was the end of it. But he's a very impractical person, I would say, and hard-headed and hard to deal with.
Yeah. And I think Jack's impression and mine, too, might have been as a legislator, there might have been some evidence of not being always a practical person there either. Mm-hmm. That could be true, too. An incredibly hard-working guy.
Yeah. You bet. That is...
And I think an intelligent guy in some respects, anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to... We've just got a few minutes left before our tape's going to expire, mm-hmm. and I want to talk to you a little bit about the Reagan movement, Jack, because I know you were very much involved in getting Ronald Reagan to... to you were involved in his presidential campaigns. And what got you interested in Reagan?
Just a good conservative politician who spoke the message to me.
And you preferred Reagan over Ford?
Yes.
Explain.
More definite, more assured, more positive kind of a politician. Not that I have anything against Ford, but...
Were you involved in any kind of a movement, any kind of an organization to promote Reagan?
Certainly I was.
Well, tell about that.
Well, just... I don't know what you want me to tell. There was an organization, yes, there was a thing here in Montana. I guess I hate to talk about myself, but in my first venture towards being national committee man, I defeated the longtime national committee man,
Bill McKay,
in a bitter, bitter thing, and that was a Reagan movement to do that.
Oh, I see. Had McKay been a Ford supporter?
Well, he was a wishy-washy fella.
Well, he'd send out a letter vote for Ford people, not infuriated the Reagan people.
I got you. So then when he came up for election again, the Reagan people got behind you.
Yes.
I see. Okay. I was probably at the convention, but I don't...
Oh, that was a bitter one. Poor Bill McKay. I like Bill very much, but boy, I met him after that vote, and he was crying. And I apologized to him, and I said, he said, "Jack, that's the first election I've ever lost in my life." And he checked out, and he was leaving the hotel just...
Huh. But he'd been Republican National Committee man for several years, you know, too, so...
Yeah, there was very few National Committee men. Before that, Whetstone and Mr. Rankin and Fred Robinson was about, there was only three or four before that. Pardon?
Fellow from Kalispell.
Jim Murphy,
yeah. Yeah, just for one term.
Yeah. And then,
well, now, so were you Republican National Committee man at the time that Reagan was president?
All the time, yeah.
Did you ever meet Reagan?
Oh, yeah, several times. Yeah, right up there, there's a picture of him. That was long before he met him. That was before he was president. I forget where the hell I met him, down in Bozeman or something.
I see, yeah. Well, do you have any thoughts about any experiences with him? I mean, did you ever have a conversation with him? Would you have been able to form an impression of him? How would you describe him?
I would describe him as probably one of the better presidents that we've had, a very strong-willed, persuasive fellow that expressed himself and got things done.
Did he ever say anything to you that you remember?
No, not personally. I can't say that he did.
Louise, did you ever meet him?
Yes, I was the chairman of his campaign for Montana.
Yeah.
And we had a state chairman, Florence Hagan. It was for Ford. And they'd interview her, and she'd say, "We're going to have, I forget what it was, 9 for Ford and 5 for Reagan," or something like that.
Yeah.
And what we did...
That was at the Republican State Convention when there'd been a straw vote taken in the primary election. And Reagan won the state. He won the popular vote.
He won every county in the state.
And so, but what I think the Ford people were trying to do is they were trying to say, well, but in fairness, mm-hmm. if we've got 20 delegates to the state convention... Mm-hmm. And Reagan won the election 70% to 30%, or whatever it was, that Reagan ought to have 14 delegates or 7 delegates and or 11 delegates, and Ford ought to have 6 or 7 or whatever, to represent the way the state went. That was their position, I think, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
And we felt winner take all. We'd worked awfully hard, Jack's group that he formulated. We went into every county and got our people lined up to vote for state committee men and women that would Reagan people. And that's how we did it, from the ground up. So when they came to the state convention, we knew pretty well locked up. In fact, that wasn't George O'Connor there? Wasn't he one of the speakers for them?
I can't remember.
I think he was. They congratulated after. My God, you were organized. Well, we were.
Yeah.
Just very, very well organized.
What was the? Now Reagan, of course, was a charismatic figure. He was handsome. He was a galvanizing public speaker, that sort of thing. And he seemed to capture the hearts of the people to a greater extent than Ford, even though Ford was an incumbent president. Right. And so it was it relatively? I don't want to deminimize what you did here, but was it relatively easy to get people to enthusiastically support Reagan in all the counties?
It was kind of a groundswell, but general feeling that Ford probably couldn't make it. He'd pardon Nixon. There was some feeling there, and better start clean. And here's a up and coming charismatic figure that's going to go over well, which he did.
Did you ever meet President Ford, the elder, the first President Ford? You were still National Committee man, weren't you, when he was?
I can't remember, but yes, I have met him. What do you mean, the elder Ford? There's only one President Ford.
The one that is the son now of the one that...
Bush is his name.
Oh, why did I say that? I meant President Bush. You're right, I meant President Bush. So you did meet the first President Bush, too, I think,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And any impressions of him?
A very nice fellow.
How was he like or different from President Reagan?
Not as forceful, not as sure of himself. You know, Reagan's asset was a great assurance. He knew what the hell he was doing, or he gave you the impression he didn't know how to get this thing done. The hell with you, just here it is. And
he'd never have said, read my lips, and then gone the other way.
No. We've just got a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about a couple more governors. I want to ask you a little bit about Governor Tom Judge, a little bit about Governor Ted Schwinden, a little bit about Governor Stan Stevens, and a little bit about Governor Mark Roscoe. Just your impressions, because Jack, you and I served in the legislature with all those gentlemen, and we had something to do with each one. So for historians that might be listening to this recording in the future, who would never have an opportunity to meet any of those people, just tell us now just briefly your impressions of Governor Tom Judge, and maybe any experience you might have had with him.
Not too impressed with Governor Judge. Liked him, a likable fellow, and everything. He never impressed me as a good governor. Schwinden did impress me. He impressed me very much. He was a good governor, knew what the hell he was doing, and knew how to get it done, and got along very well with things.
And so the difference between Schwinden and Judge was that Schwinden was more of a take charge guy.
You bet. And an honest fella. I mean, gives the impression, and was. Not a dealer. I don't know how to express it, but.
Did you ever have any personal dealings with Schwinden when he was governor? I mean, on a piece of legislation? Or?
Yes, I can't remember. He was called into the office several times. I can't. The coal tax thing, I guess I carried that. And
oh, you carried the bill to lower the coal tax?
Yeah, in the Senate.
Okay, okay. Yeah. And of course, he was supporting you on that, wasn't
he? Yes, yes. Well, of course, there was a caveat, you know, there had to be a production thing on
the,
it.
The production had to increase in order to qualify for the lower tax.
But there was other things. I remember when he made Gordon McCumber, you know.
Gordon McCumber was president of the Senate, and he made him lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and then after that he made him head of the Department of Agriculture. And I don't know how the hell it came up. I remember Schwinden said, Jack, did I do all right with the old fellow? And I said, yeah, you did the old fellow.
Because you got along pretty well, as we all did, with McCumber.
Yeah.
And then Stan Stevens.
I like, of course, Stan, a very personal friend of mine. He never had the most sparkling career as a governor, but not because he never tried, he certainly did.
And how would you describe him as a public speaker, did he impress you that way?
I guess I don't have an opinion.
Well, he definitely did me. I thought he was a really good public speaker.
You bet.
Any other impressions of Stan?
Just a hell of a nice, honest fella. And I think, I hate to say it, he just was there at the wrong time to be a very impressive governor, yeah. I guess. If things never worked out just as they should have, like they did with Roscoe, strangely enough, later on.
Roscoe followed Stevens as governor. Yeah. Any impressions? Go ahead.
Things came along nicer then, I think, maybe because Stevens set some of it up for him.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But he got the benefits of...
Stan stomped the grapes and Mark drank the wine.
Very good impression. That's right.
Very fitting.
Any other... Now, you weren't in the legislature during Roscoe's administration.
No.
Louise, I think you've got a story, don't you, to tell about Mark Roscoe? Weren't you involved with Mark Roscoe's decision to run for governor?
I think so.
I thought I remembered, or maybe it was to run for attorney general. I thought I remembered some kind of a story about he was a young deputy attorney general, and he was wondering what to do because the attorney general was running for governor, Mike Greeley. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't sure what to do with himself. And I thought the story was that you and he had a conversation, mm-hmm. and you were involved in Republican Party politics at the time, and said, "Well, why don't you run for Attorney General as a Republican?" No. And that didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
Okay. All right.
Must have been somebody else you're thinking.
Okay. Okay. I thought that was you. Who
I would have said if the occasion had arisen.
I thought it was you who had some influence in the causing him to run for Attorney General the first time. Well, we're just about out of time. Would either one of you like to conclude with anything? Is there anything you'd like to say, looking back over your lives involved in Montana history and politics and so forth?
Just thank you for coming out, Bob.
Any last words, Louise?
No, but tomorrow we'll probably think of a lot of things we should have said.
Okay.
We always do.
Well, I sure appreciate you. Thank you very much.
Well, appreciate you, Bob.
Yeah.